I'm Christopher Layden. This is Open Source. Betsy DeVos is bringing the policy edge of the Trump era about as close as it gets to kitchen table talk in every family with a bet on the schools their kids go to. The U.S. Secretary of Education is on a rethink school tour. Her pitch is relentless. The resistance tour is vigorous, too. Choice, charters, change are her keynotes. Pushing disruption by market forces of a public school scene, in her mind anyway, of kids just waiting to be saved by the bell.
Most students are starting a new school year that's all too familiar. Desks lined up in rows, teachers standing in front of the room framed by a blackboard. They dive into a curriculum written for the average student. Today, there's a whole industry of naysayers who loudly defend something they like to call the education system. What's an education system? There's no such thing. Are you guys systems? No, you're individual students.
We're putting Betsy DeVos's picture to the test this hour, starting with what anybody might see and hear just dropping in on Somerville High School next door to Boston.
I mean, there's, like, basically everyone here, and if you're here, you're going to find people that you like or you connect with. Like, there's way too many clubs. I mean, I signed up for 3 clubs and already had to quit one because I have violin lessons. Then I joined the musical, then I did art club, then I also help out in El Sistema, so.
Oh, I love it here.
Why?
It's a very kind community. Everyone's very accepting. There are no bad people in this place.
If you're in here, you belong here. If you're not here, well, then you'd put yourself outside.
Somerville will be a measure on a lot of questions this hour, like, do you know a good school when you see one? What weight do you give to diversity of race, incomes, class? What can you make of the test score averages that now get linked into real estate listings? Where do you look for engagement, real traction among students and teachers too? And when did the race to the top start to leave most kids behind? Jack Schneider gets us started. He's a school parent in Somerville, professor of education at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's on a mission, like and unlike Betsy DeVos's, to assess real school values. His new book is called Beyond Test Scores, subtitled, A Better Way to Measure School Quality. What have we been missing, Jack Schneider?
You know, all stakeholders want to know how the public schools are doing. Parents want to know. Community members want to know. People who are governing the schools want to know. And for a long time, what we've been doing is using the tool that we have available to us, standardized test scores. And what we've been trying to do is we've been trying to take the metric that we've got and map backwards to try to map it onto all the values that we have, rather than doing what we should have done in the first place, which was figure out, what do we value? Let's come up with some common ways of describing this. And then once we've done that, and once we've all agreed on what we value in terms of processes and outcomes, then let's go out and let's try to figure out how we're going to measure those things, right? Because we all want good information about our schools. We all have a stake in our schools. Our schools are a public good in addition to something that's serving our own children. But the information we have right now is so constrained and often really misleading that leads to all sorts of troubling unintended consequences like segregation. And so the only way to fight this bad data problem is with better data, right? Because right now the argument that's being pushed is you can't replace something with nothing. And so the way to replace a broken system is with a system that works.
Jack, we've got too much information in a way already. How do you refocus, as you did us in Somerville, on the tone of a school, the feeling of a school, and help us believe it?
Yeah. Think about what matters when you're walking through a school. Think about what your experience was like as a student. Think about what you value in your own kids' outcomes. When I send my daughter to school, what I want for her is to feel safe. I want her to trust her classmates. I want her to feel cared for by her teacher. I want her to be excited about learning. I want her to have opportunities to be creative and to play. I want her to explore her abilities and her interests, right? These are pretty common sense and fairly common values. And while they are fairly hard to measure, for parents who are outside of a school, there's a way to get at that information, and it turns out to be cheaper than test scores.
How did you do it? We know those things when we see them, but...
Yeah. So what we did was we built a school quality framework in Somerville by talking to every stakeholder group in the community. We talked to parents, teachers, administrators, every school principal. We talked to community members and ran those focus groups in different languages. We built a framework for school quality. We figured out how to measure these things, and we produced a data system that gives people the information they want and that aligns with the things they actually care about. And so if you want to know what school engagement is like, we've got that data now in Somerville. If you want to know how much students trust their classmates, we've got that data. If you want to know how strong relationships are between teachers and students, we've got that data. And it turns out when you measure the things that we actually care about, districts like Somerville turn out to be high-performing districts, right? Right now, by the state, Somerville is labeled as a level 3 district. Why is it a level 3 district? Because like a lot of other districts with high poverty student bodies, some percentage of high poverty students, their test scores reflect the out-of-school variables that invariably carry into school. We know from research that roughly 2/3 of educational achievement outcomes are shaped by out-of-school factors, roughly 1/3 shaped by in-school factors. If we're looking at test scores, essentially what we're doing is we're measuring the demography of a school rather than measuring the school itself.
That's a key point. Explain just what you mean. When you see high test scores, you're seeing not the school's contribution, you're seeing wealth and strong families.
Yeah, I mean, think about the things that make a kid successful on day one of kindergarten or first grade, right? Being oriented towards school in the first place, having parents who have talked up school as something that is a really positive experience because they themselves may have had a very positive experience in school. There's a quiet place for this child to be exposed to books and educational games at home. These parents have been reading to a child for years at this point. This child then enters school not only excited, but also prepared, is praised early on in school, begins absorbing the curriculum immediately. Compare this to another child who hasn't had the same advantages, right? Very quickly, what we're going to see is two paths that tell us nothing about the school because the school is the same for both of these two different children. It's telling us that one started off at a different place with lots more advantages and that the other has a big game of catch-up to play. And if all you're doing is measuring outcomes, you will forever be measuring the differences that were established in the first 5 years before school started, as well as some difference that happened because one child was far more ready to begin absorbing school on day one.
It's just common sense among the people I know, not to go by the test scores, not to decide where you're going to live or where you send your schools. What I hadn't realized, though, Jack, is that MCAS numbers, SAT numbers, all sorts of things are now tied into real estate listings. This is a shocker, and it seems to me a kind of poison. Can you explain that?
Yeah, the numbers end up being baked in. Not only is this a troubling outcome, but it's also troubling because there is no transparency in many cases about what these ratings are based on. And so you're right, there is a lot of skepticism, increasing skepticism over the past 10 or 15 years about what test scores actually tell us. But in many cases, we have websites. So Trulia is an example. Zillow is another example. Real estate websites that will allow you to filter neighborhoods based on quote-unquote school quality. Well, what are their school quality ratings based on? Do they have the data that we've got, for instance, for Somerville and for the broader consortium that I helped co-found, the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment? Mm-hmm. Do they have that kind of data? No, they don't. In many cases, what they're pulling from is simply standardized test scores for MCAS, grades 3 through 8, as well as 1 year of high school. Sometimes they're pulling SAT scores. Sometimes they're pulling graduation rates, which, even though a fairer measure, also tend to correlate with things like family income. And so what they're essentially doing is they're saying that any school that's got a diverse student body is a bad school, right? They're not saying that they're saying that, but that's the message, which is allowing people then to completely filter out neighborhoods where that would have been their neighborhood school, which is, of course, driving school segregation, which creates bad schools.
They're also telling you, without quite telling you, that if you really love your children, you should move to Newton tomorrow.
Right. That's right. And there's another problematic piece to that, right, is that there's a self-fulfilling prophecy here, which means that when they tell you to move to Newton, where median home value is, I don't know, roughly $1 million, right, there's a selection effect that these high-income parents who would have brought their resources, as well as their high test-scoring students to other schools, end up in Newton, where the Newton public schools are also good schools, but they aren't the best schools in the state of Massachusetts, not by the metrics that I would use. They're perfectly good schools. They just happen to serve a much wealthier clientele than the Somerville public schools. And I don't want to pick on Newton. There are lots of wealthy districts that get acclaim based largely on test scores, rumor, anecdote, rather than on any sort of realistic comparison of schools where people have gone through and walked through schools, where they've talked to kids, where they've sat through classes, where they've talked to teachers, where they've seen outcomes and they've seen how schools have changed kids' lives. That turns out to be pretty hard work, but again, we can begin collecting data on these things, not to cut down districts like Newton or Wellesley, but rather to show people the reality, which is that in most cases, our schools are not failing, as Betsy DeVos would say. Our schools are, for the most part, doing better today than they've ever done. Is there an inequity? Absolutely. Do we have a segregation problem? You bet. There's a lot of work to be done.
So what drives the focus, the single-minded focus on a few numbers, and just to distract us from common sense understanding that, no, some communities are more interesting and they ought to be places to aim for.
Yeah, you know, I think the focus on test scores is a product primarily of the fact that we've been comfortable with test scores. We've had test scores for over 100 years. In fact, the first standardized test was given in Boston roughly 150 years ago. We've been living with test scores for generation after generation. And at this point, we're using the tool we have rather than the tools we need.
We're just well begun on a review of school realities, school tensions, tools, choices in the age of Trump. Coming up, the school inspector we rely on, Jennifer Berkshire of the Have You Heard blog. She's been out on the trail with Betsy DeVos. She also co-hosts a wonderful podcast with Jack Schneider, whom you just heard. This is Open Source. We took our own fresh impressions of high school this week across the river in Somerville. It's an old streetcar suburb that became an ethnic city, one-time auto theft capital of the country. It's gentrifying since the 90s, still a wildly diverse, energetic community of 80,000 people, winning prizes these days for its local government. Here is a bit of what Somerville High School sounds like midday on a Tuesday. What's the range of types at Somerville High School?
Oh boy, there's like there's the people who like the sports, like jocks. There's
cheerleaders.
People in like the music,
drama, bands,
orchestra. I think.
There's just not a lot of competition here. I can just completely screw up a song and no one will even get mad. It's great.
It's like a big orchestra family.
You know, everyone's friendly, everyone's kind. It's awesome here.
Did you ever think of another high school to go to?
We were thinking of moving to Medford at one point, but the high school made us stay.
Great, nice read.
So I am in my 11th year. I came to Somerville High School from a slightly different route than most teachers. I don't have an ed degree. I have a technical master's in biology. I think the goal of any teacher is to inspire and engage the students. You know, if it's just content delivery, you can put a video on the smart board to deliver the content, but that's going to lose the students in the first 90 seconds. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things is we do, every year we do a job shadow where we take kids to a biotech company, and I want to drive into the kids that these are regular folk. Biotech is all hands-on stuff. You know, if you love auto tech, you could love biotech too.
What can a kid do coming out of this program?
So the kids in here get trained on curriculum that is aligned with the Carpenters Union. So when they step out of here, they can go directly into the Carpenters Union. They can also go directly into the work field as well as college. They have a basic understanding of how a house is framed, setting up foundations. They get a little bit of knowledge on basic roof systems. We do a lot of finish carpentry as well, cabinet installs, finish molding, stuff like that. A lot of our students, including myself, I look at myself as a kinetic learner, and we show them. We don't just tell them how to do it. We show them how to do it.
So I graduated from here in 1985. Oh, wow. My father taught here. My husband's retired from here. My whole family went here. So I've been around here for a long time. But what I hear, and this is my 19th year here, is over and over again from new people, student teachers, new students, is there's a feeling. We had an administrator who used to call us the best-kept secret in the state.
But it had all those knocks, too. I mean, Somerville, Bummerville, Dummerville, Slummerville.
Slummerville, Scummerville. We always knew. I grew up poor. Everybody around me was poor. We didn't know any differently. It was nothing to be ashamed of. You traded clothes with the families around you, and that's just the way it was. So we knew we were good people. We knew, you know, who we were.
Measure the impact of poverty on your student body. I mean, what kinds of numbers and what symptoms?
It's about 72% free and reduced lunch. That's what our kids qualify for, which is a pretty astonishingly high number. So with that, you know, most of our kids are working part-time jobs.
Really?
I would say the majority of our students are working after school. So they're school all day and they work and they try to play sports. So with that comes just stress, emotional stress. A lot of them have full houses, you know, when they have aunts and uncles and cousins living with them because they're all trying to pay rent. Rent's expensive around here. The immigration piece is a big part of our kids' lives, too. I mean, a lot of our students are undocumented or their parents are undocumented. Mm. So it's a challenge in making money legally, getting jobs, and worrying about the legal ramifications of that stuff, too. Our kids are exceptional in that sense, where they're much more mature than your average teenager, I think, and pretty resilient kids.
We have, like, an outdoor club, too, where they just explore, like, the world and stuff.
There's also, like, I think there's track team, and track there's also a chess club.
Track team just ran by. They look a lot like the orchestra.
And they're coming back.
You can do it, Brayden. I believe in you.
That was Somerville High School. Jennifer Berkshire is a roving freelance eye on the school scene in general. She's education editor at Alternet Online, and she's Jack Schneider's partner, as I said, on the podcast, Have You Heard? You were out with Betsy DeVos on the inspection tour in Ohio, Jennifer. What wouldn't Betsy DeVos like in that boisterous, welcoming, upbeat Somerville scene we just visited?
Well, the thing that you have to understand about Betsy DeVos is that when she comes into a place like Somerville, there's really one metric that she cares about: whether parents have the ability to choose where they get to send their schools. Mm. And Somerville doesn't have nearly enough choice by her measure. We have a cap on how many charter schools, so they have very few of those. There's only one high school, so she's already looking at that as sort of like a forced situation. Mm. And the thing that she cares most about in all the world, which is sending public dollars to pay for private religious schools, is not allowed under the Massachusetts Constitution. So she is already entering Somerville with a profound sense of disappointment. We have let her down in many ways.
You know, they say that she does care about schools and kids. I have a feeling in Somerville she'd be looking for three or four kids she would rescue from that place.
That is perfectly possible. And really, the issue is, you know, she might be very moved by the orchestra that you played. She might be interested in the stories of the individual kids. But the thing that she really, her main priority is choice. And so this can be kind of disconcerting because we're so used to the metrics that Jack was talking about, where our understanding of school quality has been really distorted by an overwhelming focus on math and English scores and how much they go up. She really doesn't care about that. And so as a result, like, she'll give a shout out to Arizona as a model education state, which has a 63% high school graduation rate. Massachusetts is 25% higher, but our state is, in her mind, you know, choking in red tape and burdensome regulation. So yes, she would, it's very likely that she might connect with some individual students, but she's unhappy with the very model.
In Ohio, where you covered her, Jennifer, she went head-to-head with the head of the teachers' union. To me, the surprising thing was that she didn't make a lot of headway with the people, it sounded.
That's correct. You started off this episode playing a quote from her, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but she was actually paraphrasing Margaret Thatcher.
We listened to it and said, it sounds like Thatcherism. Is there a...
Yes, because she quoted Thatcher directly a month or so before that school visit when she was speaking at the American Legislative Exchange Conference.
Yeah, Thatcher had said, there's no such thing as society. It's just, they're just families.
Exactly.
And individuals. She's saying there's no such thing as a school system. It's only...
And so imagine that you're headed to the northwest rural corner of rural Ohio, and here you have this community that's so excited to show off its school to you. It's the thing that binds them together.
Yeah.
Right? You're out in the middle of a windswept plain, and you have this libertarian billionaire come and tell you there's no such thing as a school system. There are individual parents and individual students. It makes
no
sense.
Is she just thinking I'm in red state, Trump state, Ohio?
Well, I don't think that it's been entirely thought through. I think she's very frustrated by the resistance in rural states in particular that people are sort of clinging to their public schools. And what was so interesting about that tour, if you know anything about Ohio, they've experienced one scandal after another with their virtual schools. That it turns out that when you remove, you know, the shackles of regulation, some unsavory characters can enter the edupreneurial space. And what happened is you have basically big Republican campaign donors who run these virtual schools, and they've just been sort of a sop for taxpayer money. And so there she is standing in front of this, you know, crowd of beaming teachers and students in Van Wert, Ohio, and she offers up virtual schools as a, you know, a worthy alternative for their parents. And this makes no sense to them. They are not rallying behind this agenda.
She's become such an interesting character for her wealth and her marriage, the Amway connections, billions and billions of dollars in that family, and its network in Michigan. But what's really new here? I sense a long, deepening war against public schools, despite the fact that 80% of our kids still go to them, and parents, as you say, will stick up for them.
The war is actually quite a bit longer than we are even aware of. And so, you know, we spent a lot of time in this country arguing about what kids should be taught. The last few decades, we've been in a hot war about the structure of schools. Should they be district run? Should they be charters? But we kind of all assume that everyone is on board with the idea that we have universal public education, that we hand our kids over to the state for 8 hours a day and that taxpayer money pays for it. And I think what people are really unaware of is that DeVos comes from a tradition that has never accepted that. They view the point at which the U.S. went off the rails when parents lost control of the ability to educate their kids. And so that's why in every one of those speeches that she gives, she'll always emphasize the parents know best. And it starts to get a little murky because of the business connections that you mentioned. You can end up with a situation that looks like Detroit, where parents are thrown into an unregulated choice system. They're bombarded with ads that are completely unregulated. And then her answer is, well, parents know best. We know a good school because parents are choosing it. And it must be, you know, parents are choosing it because it's good. And so we've swung in a very different direction than what Jack was talking about, but I think the war goes back so much further than what people are aware of. And it's a surprisingly mainstream way of thinking in conservative circles. So Senator Ben Sasse has that new book, The Vanishing American Adult, and he hits a very similar note, right, that the schools do too much. They took control away from the parent and they sort of nanny-stated everybody else.
Jack Schneider, we live in Horace Mann country still. What's the real pressure on public schools here?
Yeah, I think the real pressure on public schools is coming from those who want to pry open the small piece of a free market that there is here. And the piece that's new with Betsy DeVos is that, as Jennifer said, DeVos isn't particularly interested in things like test scores. She thinks that choice is inherently good. But a couple pieces of her experiences make her unique, right? Policymakers cannot separate themselves from their own personal experiences. And one of the things we've seen for the past few decades, I wrote, my first book was a book about school reform for the past quarter century. And one of the things we've seen for the past quarter century is this common sense approach to school reform, where you have folks like Bill Gates saying, you know, I went to a small high school. My friend Tom Vander Ark went to a small high school. His wife went to a small high school. Small high schools must be great because we turned out just fine. Never mind the fact that those small high schools had lots of other kinds of advantages. Well, Betsy DeVos has lots of experience in private schools and particularly in religious schools and operates in circles where everybody has had that same kind of experience and where the free market has served them quite well. And what she neglects to see here, right, and she's blinded by ideology, and what she neglects to see is the fact that it is not a free market for everybody else, even if they have unfettered choice, because they do not have the same access to elite schools. They have access to unregulated charter schools, some of which are virtual schools, some of which are for-profit, some of which are being run in the basements of storefronts in mini malls, right? That's a very different kind of market. But I think that currently, at least, Betsy DeVos's experience leads her to see that in a very different sort of way. And that's the piece that's new here. And so to get to your question in terms of what we're looking at in Massachusetts, our charter market is much more regulated than you see in a place like Michigan. And so what I would expect is not that we will end up being like Michigan, but that the real extreme that we're seeing in some other states is going to make Massachusetts look like the odd man out, and that our policies, which appear so far to have actually been pretty successful, there's a space for charters that will look like some sort of aberration.
Jack, just in Massachusetts, I'm grateful to you for pointing us back to Somerville. It's a wonderful story, and you sense it right away walking into that building. How many undervalued treasures are there that we ought to know more about?
You know, I think they're countless, actually. There are roughly 100,000 schools in the United States. And right now, most of us have real, honest-to-goodness, high-quality information about one or two or possibly three of those 100,000 schools. We've got data on all of them. But we have really high-quality information about
almost
none of
them. It's not the data, it's the happy parents and kids I want to hear from.
Well, that's exactly right, right? Because the information we've got about one or two or three schools is the information you got walking through Somerville High School, interacting with people, right? And so I want to just talk very briefly about an experiment we did where we gave people a broad, comprehensive set of data, and we asked them, now rate the school based on this data. When we gave people the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education data and asked them to rate a school they didn't know, they gave it much lower ratings than the people who actually knew that school. Mm. When we gave them broader and more comprehensive data and said, rate this school you don't know, they gave it the exact same rating that people who knew the school gave it. What does this tell us? It tells us not that there's some home team bias for the school that your own kid attends. It tells us you know that school better than the current information does, right? That you've got far more information about that school. And so we need to give everybody that information so we can discover all of these hidden gems, because there are thousands of them out there.
Jennifer Berkshire, what are the best kept secrets you stumbled on out there? And what's the mark of them?
Well, I think that, you know, you mentioned that there's this long war against public education. And when DeVos was nominated, I headed straight to Michigan and I spent, you know, a week plus motoring all over the state, talking to people. And the legacy of what's happened in Michigan goes beyond just unfettered choice that now even people in Michigan are acknowledging has caused the state to just plummet in its educational outcomes for kids. the DeVosses have led a decades-long effort to dismember the teachers' union there because it's so linked to Democrats, and really to try to weaken the democratic structures that public education represent, right? They don't like any of it. They don't like the property taxes that pay for it. They don't like the school boards. They don't like the fact that public education is about grooming citizens. They don't believe in any of that. And so people, I think, focus too narrowly. You know, they think, oh, Betsy DeVos just really doesn't like teachers' unions, or, Betsy DeVos hasn't spent any time in public schools. Actually, her critique is far deeper, goes back much further, and it has a much bigger target in its range.
The puzzle for me is how she has sold herself and is trying to sell us on a model that only a few people can win.
Well, one of the things that's so distressing about all of this is that the language she uses really doesn't sound much different from what Democrat advocates for school choice sound like, right? I can remember a time when it would have sounded really extreme to talk about a government school. But now you hear Democrat advocates, even in Massachusetts, who, are very pro-charter, using the same terminology.
Government schools instead of public schools.
Mm-hmm. A monopoly.
Yeah, this is fascinating. Coming up, a stinging report from a recent graduate on the all-American education he was forced to endure. Malcolm Harris next on Open Source. Malcolm Harris makes his book writing debut this fall at age 29 on behalf of the recent products of American schooling, often called millennials, and they're miserable about it. We are poorer, more medicated, and more precariously employed than our parents, our grandparents, even our great-grandparents, he writes. School was never about childhood or life, he told me this week, but about preparing for work that is now very hard to find. I thought he was making it up in the book when he quoted a letter to kindergarten parents in a New York town canceling the Christmas play. Given the pressures of work and career ahead, the letter said, kids just couldn't spare the time.
No, that was a real letter. I think it tells us something really fundamental about education and measurement. I think the entire idea of thinking about career readiness for five-year-olds does a disservice to the possible progress of our society because it sets those kids up to be unhappy.
In your book, Malcolm, you seem to see public education, private too, as a kind of outsourcing of work training. Explain how that goes and what's wrong with it.
Well, the way we talk about education, public-private education in general in this country, at least the way our political leaders do, is as training for future work, period.
As opposed, say, to happiness or citizenship or something.
Yeah, or citizenship or being members of your society or intellectual discovery, scientific discovery. There are a lot of things that education is good for that aren't just skills for future exploitation.
What does the testing have to do with it, Malcolm? Is there a good test that would apply to this situation?
No, Chris, I think the only good test is a dead test. I understand the idea of wanting to make sure that all kids are getting, the education they deserve, getting some kind of parity in terms of education. But we already know that's not happening. Hmm. We don't need tests to tell us anything that the tests are telling us. We can learn all of that by opening our eyes if we want to.
You write about the kids in the system. In your description and in your book, I mean, what are they going through? What are the kids going through in this scene?
So you have children working to prepare themselves to work. And that is now the center of childhood. That's the center of education. It's the center of life in America, period, is working so that you can have the ability to work. And that's incredibly stressful. It's competitive at root. And it's no way to live within society, certainly not for children.
Malcolm, through your lens, childhood has become basically a capitalist
development project and a violation of every impulse toward fun, self-expression, distraction, being on your own. It's not a brand new story, but when did it become the description of what we have?
So in my book, I date it to the late 70s and the early 80s, which is a common sort of periodization of contemporary history, I think. I do it in terms of this generational cohort, in terms of millennials. But that's a big break in terms of our society in general. That's where you see capitalism emerging as the single, unchallenged, dominant mode of organizing society. And a lot of people call it neoliberalism. That's the time period of neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm.
One of the standard knocks against neoliberalism is that we're being trained to be consumers. But I think more important, we need to look at the way we're being trained to be workers for exploitation, to generate the skills that owners need to generate profits. And I think that's a underestimated important part of the neoliberal turn.
Malcolm Harris's book, out in November, is called Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. Charles Peterson is a senior editor at N Plus One, the hip young quarterly out of Brooklyn. Same time, he's writing his doctoral thesis in American Studies at Harvard on the slippery buzzword meritocracy. In my lifetime, Charles, meritocracy made our middle class, for better and worse, I suppose. But now it's got Malcolm Harris in a rage. How did we come to this point?
You know, I think it's an interesting story, and Malcolm definitely gets part of it. The kind of pressures that we've been talking about this whole hour really increased a lot in the 1980s and 1970s. But it's a story that goes back, I think, further than he recognizes, at least in that discussion. What I've looked at is kind of the rise in pressures to get into elite colleges in the 1950s and 1960s. It's basically
me and my sibs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'd be curious to hear what it felt like for you. In my experience, so I went to the archives at Stanford University into the admissions files. And what I found out is that in 1950 at Stanford, they admitted basically every single man who applied. You only needed an SAT score of 350 on the verbal part of the test to get in. 20 years later, they're only admitting 10% of the students who apply. And so this is a really radical shift that happens kind of in national level higher education institutions, which then trickles back down to the kind of local schools we're talking about, where intense pressures start to be applied to students that just weren't there 10 or 20 years before. So that's really, I think, the origin point of meritocracy and why it's so important to think about this as something that goes back so far. At the time, people really had a critique of this. They saw this as an incredibly dangerous, brand new phenomenon. In 1958, the sociologist of education, Nathan Glaser, hears that one of his nieces can't get into college. And he says, you know, we should start using a lottery to do this. And David Reisman, another scholar of education, says basically, you know, meritocracy is kind of a dystopia. It's exactly what we don't want. And so it's a remarkable story how you go from basically everyone is critiquing this new system in the 50s and 60s to today, where meritocracy is in general a very positive buzzword. Outside of the left, when people critique meritocracy, what they're usually asking for is more meritocracy.
I was going to say, for me, meritocracy meant a kind of liberation. It was tests that would find talent that was uncredentialed, some whose parents hadn't all gone to college. It was an ethnic thing. Later, it opened up the world to women, too. But it was an almost complete good. It was a victory over, should we say, the tired old... I won't say WASP aristocracy, but the people who had the franchise.
Well, the problem, Chris, is that the problem is too many people started doing well on those tests, right?
And then we discovered that it wasn't
for everybody, really.
Absolutely. But consider the fact that, you know, this trend of increasingly competitive college admissions is being driven by the fact that we have more and more students graduating from high school in this period of time. And so if we are viewing schools as a private good, right, that gives us tokens that will provide us access to goodies in social and economic life, then all of a sudden, the fact that more people are getting a high school education pushes us to get a college education. Well, the people who had been getting a college education already had to get an elite college education. Around this time in the 1950s, we see the creation of the Advanced Placement Program, which allows students to thereby distinguish themselves from their peers in an ostensibly meritocratic way. And of course, we see that the way this plays out is that those with privilege continue to angle for advantage over the less privileged in a way that manifests quite clearly in the 1980s, where a teacher in East Los Angeles becomes famous because his kids in a high poverty, largely Hispanic school are passing the AP calculus test at high rates. And what do elite schools do in response? 20 years later, they've almost all dropped the AP program because it no longer gives their kids an advantage.
Charles, I want to know how Canada escaped the tiny fragmentation of, the concentration of prestige on a few schools and that probably don't deserve it, but the exclusion of so many kids.
Yeah, I think in the United States, it's easy to feel like, you know, the system we have is hard and it ruins young lives, but it's just kind of inevitable. This is just what it is to be in a modern world. It's to compete to get into college. And then I meet someone from Canada and I tell them, you know, about my adolescence. I'm a millennial and they think I sound crazy.
Why so? I mean,
basically, so in Canada, you know, you don't really have private universities or very few. And all the universities are roughly the same level. You don't have institutions that are vastly more prestigious than others. And so the result is that, you know, if you want to go to college, you're going to go to the college near where you live. Or you might say, oh, you know, I live in Toronto. I really want to go to Vancouver. So I'll go to Vancouver. You're not going to be spending your adolescence competing against your peers, the other people in your school, the other people across town, across the nation, to get into a few peak institutions that then will give you access to the elite.
Did we choose not to take the Canadian plan, so to speak?
If we chose, we probably did so at a much earlier time when we, you know.
But why would we have?
So I think the vision of some people, like, for instance, David Riesman, who I was discussing earlier in the 50s and 60s, was that instead of places like Harvard getting more and more prestigious by going from the old kind of WASP aristocracy to this new meritocracy, his idea was that these institutions should get less prestigious. And other institutions, you know, like the new University of California schools, they built eight, they ended up with eight by the end of the 60s, would rise in prestige. And so the end result would be that people could go to college wherever they wanted and competition would diminish. What they really feared was that the competition that had driven capitalism for the past 200 years would just keep on going endlessly, and that it would really affect not just kind of everyday work life, but the lives of children as well. And that's what they wanted to avoid.
Is there an end to this process? Does it get more and more and more competitive, more expensive, more exclusive? Or is there a turn coming?
I certainly hope there is. And you can see this in some institutions like Bowdoin College, for instance, I know has abandoned the SAT as a criteria they use for admissions, or at least made it optional. And I think, you know, it's a good question. Will parents at some point get fed up? Will they opt out? I hope so, but it's not something I see right now. I have to say the future in this regard does not look very bright.
What does your future look like, Jennifer?
Well, you started out this episode talking about sort of education in a time of Trump. And when you think about the, you know, how we've come to see education as a zero-sum game and the intense competition and how all that's taking place against a backdrop of the cratering of public investment. And then, you know, we wake up one day and the country is seething with resentment. And, you know, you think about that quote that you played from Betsy DeVos and how that, you know, she's telling us there is no public system. There is no collective good. There's just, you know, young Christopher Lydon competing against young Jack Schneider for, you know, who can get to the top of the apple heap.
Jack Schneider, it's you or me.
Oh, Well,
or maybe Jennifer.
I'll give it to you. But before I do that, I want to just make an observation here. And that's that, you know, one of the core problems is our insistence as a society that meritocratic outcomes can be determined through our schools. You know, our insistence on playing that game is what leads people to view education as a private good rather than as a public good and to compete against each other. And of course, in a competition like that, those with the most resources and the most privilege will win. And this is true not only in higher education, where the game is to get into the most prestigious college, whether or not you'll learn anything once there, but it trickles all the way backwards to get into the right college. You not need to be into the right high school. To be in the right high school, you need to have gone to the right middle school, the right elementary school, the right kindergarten, and the right preschool. And across all of these settings, learning is irrelevant, right? Learning is not important. What's important is acquiring the tokens that will get you to the next level. And so this brings us all the way back to Somerville. Are those kids getting the most valuable tokens? Maybe not. But what are they learning in the classroom? Beyond what they're learning socially from being in a hugely diverse school, beyond what they're learning through all the hands-on programs that the school's got. They're also learning all the stuff that every other kid in the state is learning in classrooms where there are good teachers who are invested in them and who are teaching them poetry, no matter what field they're going in, who are teaching them how to reason like mathematicians and scientists, how to express themselves through writing, right? Ultimately, these things can happen in any kind of school and in any kind of classroom, regardless of prestige.
They're learning the pleasure of woodworking, Jack, in that shop with Mario.
You love Mario.
Mario knocked me out. But I'm struck by Malcolm Harris's remark that so many kids now, almost from kindergarten, are going to hard work every day to be ready for work that it turns out may not be there. It's a bit of a nightmare.
There was a story in the Boston Globe today about the frenzied competition to win the new Amazon corporate headquarters. And Amazon, once in its proposal, once evidence that the communities applying for it offer computer coding and, you know, and various computer programs in their elementary school. And so it's literally, you know, training the workforce of tomorrow. And I thought, oh, what a depressing vision.
Charles, I'm still remembering James Bryant Conant in the post-war discovery of the SAT, the ability to, almost like a Geiger counter, to go out there and find undiscovered talent. And it seemed like such a breakthrough. Will we ever go develop the test to find everybody else and depreciate their claim on those pleasures and that joy themselves?
Yeah, I think the power of the SAT in the 1950s was really remarkable. There's an economist, James Tobin, who won the Nobel Prize, who tells a story about, you know, he just thought he was an average kid, not that smart, and then he takes an IQ test, and it tells him he's a genius, and that changes his life. And so he goes on to do, you know, great work for our society, I hope. I don't know, he's an economist. But I think that, you know, like Malcolm Harris said, at this point, it feels like even though tests can do these amazing things, they've been exploited so much that it's so easy to think, you know, the only good test is a dead test. I think, too, the crucial thing is that in the 1950s, people thought, you know, we had reached such a point of affluence. The United States was so wealthy that we could leave some of these things behind. We didn't need to be so competitive anymore. And so I think, you know, one place that I look for hope was that in the Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, he keeps saying, you know, this is the wealthiest country in the world. We can really do these things. We can have, you know, medicine for all. And so maybe that's one way we could actually escape this, is realize that we have the wealth. We don't need to be, you know, teaching five-year-olds how to code.
We've got to uncreate this scarcity that we love so much.
But again, the problem is that scarcity benefits a group of people by allowing them to act as if their their social and economic advantages are the product of a combination of talent and hard work rather than a product of an advantage that they have always had. And so when we look at the SAT, for instance, what we see is that it initially worked as a meritocratic mechanism until people began to figure out, you know how you get better at the SAT? Not by getting smarter, but by practicing for it and getting tutoring. And so what we see today is that SAT scores correlate very strongly with family income, which is why all forward-thinking colleges and universities ought to do, as my institution has done as well, make the SAT optional.
We're gonna uncreate scarcity, Jennifer. You, I, Betsy DeVos.
I look forward to doing that together.
I do too. Thank you, Jennifer Berkshire, and Charles Peterson, and Jack Schneider. Thanks also to Malcolm Harris and the intrepid students and teachers at Somerville High School, and to Tennessee Watson at Wyoming Public Media. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. Susan Coyne makes our beautiful illustrations online. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our principal. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.